May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, this is an employment case, despite the way it may look from some of the amicus briefing. Mr. Reed was promised by the Riley Company that if he worked long enough, if he worked hard enough, that he would obtain some degree of job security. He was told that if he worked there for longer than 3 years, he would receive 60 days notice of termination, during which time he would continue to receive payment. So he would have a chance to figure out what he was going to do with the next step in his life. Mr. Reed met his obligations. He worked there for 5 years. And Riley, one day at the end of October 2015, terminated him with no prior notice and then told him that we're not going to pay you the 60 days commission that we promised you. And if you look at Exhibit 1 to the broker agreement, it becomes clear why. And it's because it says in Exhibit 1 that you're really an at-will employee and we can terminate you at any time.
You're arguing the merits, and the trial court enforced the form selection clause and didn't get to the merits. Is that correct?
So I guess my point, the point of the argument is yes, it did. The judgment says it's dismissed, subject to refiling in Johnson County, Kansas. But my arguments with regards to the fraud, the illusory nature of the employment agreement, the Merchandising Practices Act, all go towards the enforceability of the form selection clause. So I believe they are properly at issue in this case if the court reaches them. So Riley told Mr. Reed that they weren't going to pay him. They terminated him effective immediately. But he's expected to honor this three-year non-compete clause that's no longer can do business with friends or family, and it's for 3 years, and it's unlimited in geographic scope. Mr. Reed brought suit to declare the contract void and invalid because the consideration that was promised was illusory on the basis that they weren't really required to give him 60 days notice and continue to pay him, because it said in the Exhibit 1 to the broker agreement that this is at will and you can be terminated at any time. He also brought suit for fraud based on the misrepresentations that induced him into the contract, and he brought suit for violations of the Commission Salesperson Act, which is sections 407.911 to 915 of the Merchandising Practices Act. Based on some of the extraneous documents and assertions in Riley's reply suggestions in support of its motion to dismiss, the first argument that we've raised on appeal is that the trial court failed to exclude these documents or convert the motion to dismiss into a motion for summary judgment.
Doesn't it make sense that the court would look to the form selection clause at the very outset of the case and decide whether that was clear, unambiguous, enforceable, or not enforceable? Because all these claims that you're making can be made in the alternative forum. The issue is, do you have to make them there? And why isn't that an initial question that requires no evidence on behalf of the trial court?
And I would agree.
And that so the trial court said they granted a motion to dismiss. So our cases say the presumption is that's what it did, that it did not consider those other documents.
Yes.
So what is there about the status of the pleadings that the court erred at law in granting the motion to dismiss, assuming that it was solely based on the forum selection clause?
So there's a couple issues. One of them is, that's the only place that there's any kind of reference to Riley's assertion that it's exempt from the Merchandising Practices Act. It only applies.
I understand the Court of Appeals got there, but why does anybody get to that question other than at a merits hearing in the proper form?
So the CSA, Section 407.914, provides for jurisdiction in Missouri courts, and then it also provides that any provision in a contract which seeks to deprive somebody, a commissioned salesperson, of the provisions of the CSA shall be void. So the argument is that because this invalidates any provision in a contract that seeks to deprive somebody of those provisions, that this form selection clause is void. And it's similar to the issue that was in High Life.
Well, the form selection clause is different than the what law will be applied. And I know there's a provision on that, too, that hadn't been talked about. But why wouldn't, if this court were to find a different state as the proper form, wouldn't that state have to apply the MMPA? Why does it mean that that's not governing?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
You're saying that you'd be deprived of the MMPA and of its benefits. Why would you, just because you're in a different forum? If it governs, it governs.
So
it doesn't govern, it doesn't govern.
There's
you're assuming a different state's forum would not apply the Missouri MMPA, but that it would apply in the Missouri court. And doesn't it depend where the contract is based, whether it governs or not?
There's some Kansas case law, and I don't have it offhand, but it says that actions that occur outside of the state of Missouri, that Kansas courts will not enforce the MPA.
Okay.
But I understand the argument, and I was going purely off High Life, as it said that Kentucky courts in the case of High Life hadn't interpreted, or Missouri courts hadn't interpreted the liquor franchise laws at issue in the MPA. And it said that it would be unreasonable to abrogate the responsibility of interpreting these laws to the state of Kentucky because they had nothing to go off of. And so it said public policy favors Missouri courts, you know, deciding this issue. And also, the argument essentially here is that the contract, there never was a contract. This contract was illusory. The consideration that was promised was false. So regardless, this form selection clause shouldn't apply.
What if this been an arbitration?
The form selection clause.
What if this, instead of a form selection clause, or the form selection clause said, instead of Kansas, that this would go to an arbiter? Wouldn't our arbiter laws suggest that the arbiter would have to decide whether or not the contract was void, and if the contract was determined void, then it could be returned for trial or further proceedings at the Missouri court.
So the difference is, I know there's a comparison between form selection clauses and arbitration, but arbitration is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, and here it's governed completely by common law. And I don't know that there's any Missouri common law that says that you have to transfer a form selection clause to the forum. I mean, it specifically says Missouri courts have to determine the enforceability.
I guess my concern here is it seems that we have to get to the merits of whether or not the contract's valid or not, which is exactly what the forum selection clause was supposed to address. And so why couldn't the Kansas courts determine whether or not this contract was void? And if so, then they would give you the opportunity to return to Missouri to battle out your claims, your meritorious claims.
I mean, I guess the best answer I can come up with to that right now is that case law, going back as far as you can look it up, says that the plaintiff is the master of their case. You know, you can frame the pleadings how you wish, you can file in whatever court is proper jurisdiction, and Missouri courts are proper jurisdiction, and it's been conceded by the Riley Company that that's the case. I understand your point. You know, Mr. Reed is a citizen of Jackson County. He's lived here all his life, and
What case law? What's the best case law that Missouri courts determine the validity of form selection clause?
Your Honor, if I could address that on rebuttal,
sure.
I will definitely do
Thank
that.
Thank you.
I want to get into this argument in point three. Is that the exemptions, if there is evidence that Riley is a company that's licensed and insured, or licensed and chartered, regulated by the Missouri Department of Insurance, the exemptions expressly apply only to this section. And that was changed back in 1986. It used to say, nothing herein contained shall apply to these entities. The legislature changed it and said, nothing contained in this section shall apply to these entities, one of those being companies that are chartered, licensed, or regulated by the Missouri Department of Insurance. And this court in Landman versus Ice Cream Specialties addressed the word section as compared with a different term, which was all costs under these proceedings, or the whole of the proceedings. And it said the legislature chose to use these two different words in different subsections of the same statute. And therefore, it's presumed the legislature didn't commit an idle or superfluous act. And these words have meaning, essentially. Section means section. The whole of the proceedings is broader than that. If you look at a section 020, in subsection 1, they use the word subsection. It says violations of this subsection. If you look at 020.2, they use the word section and chapter at the end for the exceptions to the exemption. Section 3, they use a violation of this section as a Class E felony. If you look at the definitions, 010, those definitions only apply 010 to 130. Mr. Reed sued under sections 911 to 915. They make no reference to any other section of the MPA. It's wholly based on these five sections of the statute that provide their own individual cause of action for the facts as they apply to his situation. If, as was implied by the Court of Appeals decision, if everything in the MPA is an unlawful practice as defined by 020.1, by that subsection, then why are these entities exempt from other sections within the MPA? There's numerous other sections that are outlined in my brief, and these same chaptered entities are exempt from those sections as well, which really would make no sense if they were already exempt from the entire chapter. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if I could.
Your Honor, judges,
it would seem that we are in an awkward situation here because we have a circuit court that simply approved a garden variety jurisdiction selection clause, one that said, these issues will be determined in the state of Kansas, the contract will be interpreted in the state of Kansas, and it will be enforced in the state of Kansas. And when Judge Rolden at the Circuit Court of Jackson County looked at the briefing on that issue, on that specific issue, he said, yes, this is dismissed without prejudice to allow the case to be refiled in Johnson County District Court, the forum selected by the parties.
Before a Missouri court executes a forum selection clause or gives effect to a forum selection clause, it seems to be reasonable that it would determine whether it was valid. And the validity of it may come from a determination of some of the merits of the validity of the contract.
Is it fair and reasonable? And the issues of whether it was fair and reasonable, whether it was appropriate, whether it would be appropriately enforced by a Missouri Circuit Court, was the first thing that it was addressed in that in the presentation to Judge Rolden. And we have a situation here where that contract was in effect for 5 years. For 5 years, the agent received commissions, apparently without difficulty or issue, from Riley, and they went forward implementing and utilizing all the provisions of that fairly extensive contract. The offices of Riley that were utilized by Mr. Reed were in Johnson County, Kansas. That was not their primary office. Their primary office is in Leavenworth, Kansas. But the forum selected was the place where he reported every day, where he had a computer, where he had a phone, where he called, made calls.
Was that all in the pleadings, or does that require outside evidence, or is this all from the pleadings?
This was all from the motion to dismiss, which, and this is in the record on appeal.
Did it rely on opposing counsel saying that you relied on documents and that turned it into a summary judgment, not a motion to dismiss?
Okay. On the motion for summary judgment issue. The only differential...
The points you're making about where he worked and everything, I'm simply asking you, is that in the petition? Is that in the answer? Or was that in...
Was that
dependent on documents outside that?
I cannot remember exactly what was in the petition, but I can tell you lots of it was. The fact that he worked for 5 years, I believe, was... The fact that he and Exactly where the office was is not exactly clear from that petition. I can't tell you. I can tell you that the memorandum in support of the motion to dismiss addressed those issues, and they were conceded or certainly not contested by Mr. Reed at the time that he made his presentations to Judge Roldan by written form. There was no oral argument.
Roldan,
I'm sorry. So we really never appeared in front of him. He did exactly what is done in arbitration cases and in other cases. He looked at the document. It appeared to be appropriately decided in Johnson County, whether it was void, whether the MMPA applied, whatever law was going to be applicable to it would be determined by the forum the parties selected as a part of the contract of employment, as a part of that contract of employment for which they worked 5 years. So it seems to me that this is really a garden variety forum selection clause, and it has had many overlays come in as a result of primarily the MMPA. I think I've addressed whether it was fair and equitable, and I think it meets the vast majority of the factors that have been imposed by this court in some of its decisions on forum selection clauses. The issue is really, there's been a confused discussion of jurisdiction. It was noted by the Court of Appeals that it was confused by the plaintiff in some sense. There's no question that 407.914 grants jurisdiction to commission issues between a principal and between an agent. We've never denied that there is jurisdiction. There's jurisdiction to make the determination this is not the proper forum. So, and that's exactly what he did, and he placed it in the proper forum. So I don't fully understand those issues. The MMPA issues really are very significant in this case. We've had five different amicus parties file three separate briefs on the issue of whether 407.020.2 sub 2 exempts financial institutions and insurance companies.
Do we reach that if we agree with you on the forum selection clause?
Pardon me?
Do we reach that issue if we agree with you on the forum
selection clause? I don't think you do. I don't know exactly how this got here in terms of your reviews and how that worked. But it seems to me that there's a rule, I think it's 83.09, where you might determine this would be improvidently granted in this sense. The forum selection clause is clearly applicable, enforceable. I can't think of a reason it wouldn't be enforced. But the MMPA issue need not be decided today, and this is the wrong vehicle to decide that very significant MMPA case. I think the briefs of the amicus parties have done an excellent job of sort of addressing it. I sense from your comments, Judge Stith, that you don't want me to address the MMPA.
No. I was just asking whether
you
thought they were dependent on each other.
I don't see how you get there. Okay. But let's put it this way. If you do get there and if you address those issues, you clear up a very important area of the law, one where there's been, I think, the NLCL, National Consumer Law Center amicus brief showed you something like 23 different cases. Most of the consumer cases that went one way were determined, I think, at circuit courts. On appeal, virtually all the cases, there's like 15 cases there, that find that 407.020.2 sub 2 exempts insurance companies, exempts finance companies, banks, and so on, exempts regulated utilities, because it's not helpful to the regulators to have another gray area of fraud-type allegations.
What's helpful to regulators is not for us. That's for the legislature, right?
It's for the legislature, but this is getting to legislative intent. What are they doing? Obviously, what they're doing is they're saying, we think this is needed for lots of areas within Missouri commerce, but not for those areas heavily regulated. The amicus brief of the Missouri Banking Commission and the Missouri Insurance Commission, Banking Association, that does a really good job of showing just how many different acts have gone throughout every year there's another little mini act addressing lemon wheelchairs and addressing foreclosure acts and rent to buy cases and other areas of statutes that go into that. How do you know when it is, how do you know whether that is going to apply with all of those issues to insurance companies and to finance companies? Should it? Of course not. Insurance, there are two full volumes of Missouri statutes that regulate insurance companies in every practice, from commissions to beginning to underwriting to sales to what you can and cannot do. There's a commissioner that does that. You're registered to do that. The commission, if you start to fail in certain areas, your registration is looked at carefully by the commissioner.
The Supreme Court in the Highlight case looked at whether or not to enforce a form selection clause as to whether the area of law was kind of uniquely, under a policy matter, whether the area of law was uniquely one that Missouri courts ought to determine. And that if the law was not clear, that was a reason not to enforce the form selection clause. Does your argument fall within, and should we not enforce the form selection clause so that we can resolve the issues you're raising?
If you do that, you essentially are trumping 15 cases that have decided the forum, that have decided the MMPA does not apply to this particular situation. So it's not clear to me that you can say, we'll pick and choose when we're going to enforce a forum selection clause, depending on whether we want to review another issue that might be ripe for determination. It would appear to me that there are other cases. There's Myers versus Kendrick, 2017 case, Southern District of Missouri, on these very same issues from a title insurer. These cases are going to get here. You're going to get a chance to see that. You can tell from the interest you have from the amicus parties. So you're going to address those issues. I'm just not sure this is the one where it needs to be. But if you do address it, it seems to me the Rashad determination and the cases below it are crystal clear. This is a highly regulated area. We don't need more statutes for it. That's why that exemption exists. And These really do work well under that interpretation. Insurance, finance, banks are exempted from the rest of Chapter 407. Nothing else.
Opposing counsel says there's a number of other sections that exempt them, and there would be no purpose to that if this applied and exempted them from everything.
I am unaware of those. And I would have to take a look at those particular issues. When I heard that, I thought to myself, I'm not sure exactly which ones he's talking about. But I can tell you 407.020.2 sub 2 specifically at the bottom says it will be done by statute empowering the citizen.
And well, if you're getting to the section, it also says this section. So why did they use those words?
They used it because it was a 1967 statute that at the time had 13 sections,
and
that was the most primary.
Did the word section mean something different in 1967?
It did not. It would seem to me that section, in a perfect world, we might have chapter instead of section. And I would tell you, I think chapter might work better than section for that. But that interpretation is myopic. You're not seeing the forest for the trees. You really need to look at the purpose of the exemption. And that is because these are highly regulated areas that don't need that statute. And when you think about it in those terms, it makes sense. If you do it the other way, you essentially end up with what the court in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals said in the Rashaw case, which was, if you interpret it section to mean everything else that is issued is an exception of 407.02.2 sub 2. If you do it that way, essentially you are eradicating the exemption. And it makes no sense to have two statutes that one statute totally disagrees with the other statute. I think that I have that statement exactly. I haven't said it very well. The contention that one provision of the MMPA completely negates another violates well-accepted principles of statutory construction. And what they really were saying here is, hey, if we want insurance or finance or other areas to be regulated by a 407 provision, we'll say so. We'll say that a private citizen can sue insurance companies or finance companies or others, and then it's crystal clear. And that's what that is essentially what the direction of 407.020.272 is. I think with that, are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hunter, to answer your question, on the cases that say that Missouri courts have jurisdiction to consider the validity of form selection clauses, the cases cited in my brief are Whelan Security Company Incorporated, Chase Third Century Leasing Company Incorporated, and Burke versus Goodman. And they rely on High Life, and it says that in order to determine whether the form selection clause is enforceable, you look to whether it's would be unfair or unreasonable to enforce it.
Do you disagree with the Court of Appeals' conclusion that you look at, on this question, you look at the forum selection clause in isolation? You don't look at whether the entire agreement is valid or fair or reasonable. You look and see only if the forum selection clause is fair and reasonable.
Now, I think that they're relying on some of this court's more recent decisions that address arbitration clauses. I don't believe that's the case for form selection clauses. If the contract is invalid, I believe that the form selection clause also should be invalid. The argument that I made to the Court of Appeals is, even if that's the case, and it wasn't something that I was aware of with the differences between form selection clauses and arbitration clauses, there would have to be consideration for each part of the contract to enforce it. And sure, you can have different agreements that all are part of one agreement. And the argument was that there's no additional consideration for this form selection clause. It just provides it's in Johnson County, Kansas, which is a principal place of business for the Riley Company. It's not neutral and reciprocal. The other thing that I want to make a quick point of is these claims don't fall within the scope of the form selection clause. It only applies to claims that seek to interpret and enforce the contract. And Mr. Reed doesn't want to enforce any part of this contract. He wants a declaration the contract is invalid, and he's seeking statutory and common law claims of fraud. Finally, Your Honors, I wanted to discuss his mention of these cases that he claims are directly on point. None of them are on point. 407.025, which is not at issue in this case, it provides for a cause of action based on violations of 407.020. And that's where that conflict comes from. That's why they say, well, they're suing under this section, but this section exempts these entities, so it's a circular argument. 911 through 915 it's not for a violation of 020. It's for a violation of 911 through 915. There's nothing to exempt. The exemptions just don't apply. There's no further questions. We would ask for the case to be remanded. Thank you.